Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Someday, the economic bust will end, but it won't end the same for all parts of the country or even all parts of individual communities, says my guest today. Famed urban theorist Richard Florida says some cities, regions will come back like gangbusters. Others, he argues, may be finished or profoundly changed. This hour On Point, Richard Florida on America's coming post-crash economic map. You can join the conversation. How do you see the crash reshaping the nation? And when the dust settles on our financial bust, what industries, cities, regions do you think will rise? A special welcome today to our listeners on 1019 WDET in Detroit. We are delighted to have you with us. Later this hour, as it turns out, we'll hear from Detroit Mayor Ken Cockrell Jr. Joining me now from Toronto is Richard Florida, acclaimed urban theorist now at the University of Toronto Business School. He's author of the internationally best-selling books The Rise of the Creative Class and Who's Your City? His cover story for The Atlantic magazine on newsstands now is How the Crash Will Reshape America. Richard Florida, welcome back to On Point.
Oh, it's always great to be with you, Tom.
It's great to have you. You look back at history and you say it almost never fails. Big economic events change the economic map. Give us some proof points there, Richard.
Well, you know, about September, the folks at The Atlantic, the wonderful folks at The Atlantic, asked me if I would undertake to write something on how the crash was going to impact New York City. And the original thought was, well, it's going to be pretty darn bad. We had this long conversation, and I had always studied kind of capitalist, what we used to call capitalist economic crises back in the 70s and 80s. And I went back and I looked at the previous crashes, the so-called Long Depression that ran from 1870, and some say, depending on who you ask, into the 1890s.
Right.
And then the Great Depression that my own father told me all about, 1929 to World War II. And what I found is when you look at that, that big, great financial center cities, even though financial centers collapse and financial employment declines, whether that's New York or London, tend to do well. Now, of course, London was once the number one city, and New York was the number two or three or even four. But both cities have fared well over the past several centuries. And of course, New York then caught up to London. But then recently, again, London caught up again to New York. What I found was, though, they have a much bigger effect on resetting geography. And just to make a long story short, and we can go back if you want, the crisis of the late 19th century moved us in the United States, but also in most of the advanced countries, from a mainly rural set of settlement patterns, you know, and they had mercantile towns, and, you know, Boston was a lovely place, and New York was a port town in Philadelphia, to these massive industrial cities like Buffalo, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Detroit, Chicago. And then the crisis of the 30s, the Great Depression, gave us the rise of mass suburbanization. And one of the things the article points out is that it's not suburbanization is just a deconcentration of population or it's just sprawl. It actually gave us a more intensive use of urban space and land. It spread us out, but it moved retail and office functions and residences to these giant metropolitan areas. And what the piece tries to say is we're going through another great reset today, in which it's just not our technologies and industries and consumption that will change. In order to kind of spur recovery, we're going to have to change the way we live and our entire and how we live and our entire lifestyle. So that's kind of the basis of the piece.
So you've got a new map emerging here, winners and losers. We'll talk about that. And then within communities, you're saying reshaping. You're saying we need to stop subsidizing home ownership, maybe to look at rental more seriously. We'll talk about why that may be the case. On New York, you say 8% or so of jobs in New York are related to the financial positions, for the finance industry. You look around the country and say, you know what, there's a lot of places with a much higher percentage than that, 18% in Des Moines, not higher, but high, even higher, 13% in Hartford, 10% in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, in Charlotte, North Carolina. You've got Omaha, Nebraska, and Columbus, Ohio all have a bigger percentage of population working in the financial center than New York does. But it's not just finance jobs. When you look around the country, start to paint the big picture for us. Who wins regionally? Who loses on the other side of this bust, and why? What's your theory of the case?
Well, the core of my work over the past couple of decades is that we've been going through a kind of massive economic shift, equivalent to the shift, I think, of the late 19th century. At that time, we moved from an agrarian-based economy, where raw materials and fertile soil were the source of our wealth, to a mass industrial economy, where we took human physical labor, you know, masses of immigrants like my grandparents from Italy, combined them with this incredible natural resources that we were God-given in the United States. And we built these kind of new technology-intensive mass production industries, beginning with steel, but then automobiles, electronics, and chemicals. And now, of course, sadly to say, and I say this as having a father who quit junior high school at age 13 to take up work in a factory, and aside from serving in World War II as an infantry soldier, my dad spent his entire adult life working in the same factory, Victory Optical, making eyeglasses in Newark, New Jersey. But we are shifting out of a mass production industrial economy, as that has been outsourced and offshored and technologically robotized, to an economy where human knowledge, human capital, creativity is the word I like to use, is kind of the cornerstone of our economic growth. And that is shaping a whole new way of economic organization. And also, it benefits some cities and some regions to a greater extent than others. So, yeah, I think we're going to see a shift in the way we live generally, but we're also going to see a shift in the regional axes of power. Now, this has been going on for the past two or three decades. The crisis was just bring it into sharper relief.
Crisis is an accelerant. So stand back and paint that picture. We know what the outline of the USA looks like. You say it'll be spiky. That is not just flat, like Tom Friedman says, but spiky economic robustness. Where are those spikes going to be high? Where low? Who's on the other side of this crisis? Who's looking well lined up to succeed, and who's not?
Well, folks listening in at the Atlantic Monthly site or at our site at creativeclass.com, you can actually look at the maps of a spiky world. And I must say, you know, I'm a big fan of Tom Friedman's writing and have learned a ton from him. And when he argued that the world is flat, a very compelling argument, he's following a long line of thinking that says, with the rise of a human capital-driven economy, because we're less dependent on raw materials and land, if you will, big factories, and because we have an incredible rate of technological innovation, look at our conversation today, taking place from my office in Toronto to your studios in Boston. We can connect and wirelessly connect wherever we are, and we have fast transportation. Well, of course, that would mean that population would decentralize, and we would move into a world in which people could essentially, in Friedman's world, plug and play from any place they are. But what we did with a group of researchers here at the Martin Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto and others, we actually took a look at these satellite images of the world at night. What you find when you do that is that there's about 40 mega regions, and that's what the spiky world is really about. The Great Boz Wash, Boston, New York, Washington corridor, 50 million people, $2 trillion in economic output. Chi-Pitz, which runs from Chicago to Detroit to Cleveland to Pittsburgh.
Chi-Pitz, who comes up with these Boz Wash Chi-Pitz?
There's a great geographer named John Gottman who actually made up these first two names. And then we had fun, you know, Ambrustwerp in Europe, and we made up Barcelone in Southern Europe. We made up our own fun names in kind of the tradition of Gottman. But the point is that these 40 mega regions account for less than 20% of the world's population, and about two-thirds of all economic output, about 9 in 10 of the world's innovations. And these mega-regions, and in China, you know, with all the hype with the Oscars, this is really interesting. It's not that we're competing with India. We're competing with a corridor that runs from Mumbai to Bangalore. We're not competing with China. We're competing with the Shanghai-Beijing corridor.
So bring it home. Name names in the United States. You say Boston to Washington, what? It comes back, and why? Chi-Pitz, it comes back, and why? And what about Chi-Det? Put Detroit on that map. Or Cleveland, Buffalo. For that matter, what about the Sun Belt? You're very gloomy about
this. Tor Buffchester with Buffalo. Well, I think that the older industrial cities, you know, are taking a body blow and have been for a long time. And we have to, you know, what has happened in the previous recessions in the post-World War II era is that the working class and working class communities have simply gotten clobbered. And we've tracked this data now for more than 50 years. It's not the creative class and knowledge workers. Washington, D.C., the canonical knowledge worker community, is actually faring quite well in this economic reset. The Sun Belt, the cities, and we talk a lot about this in the piece, the cities of sprawl and sand that were built with literally real estate as their only economic engine.
Phoenix, Las Vegas.
Las Vegas is even a better. Phoenix now, since we wrote the piece, will experience the first loss of population in its history.
After super growth there.
Las Vegas, you know, according to that wonderful Case-Shiller index that they've tracked the housing values over time, like a third of its value already declining. Phoenix, close second. Many of these cities that were built on, and we, for the piece, we actually went and looked at the share of an economy composed of real estate agents, real estate management, construction. And in Phoenix, it was almost 30% of the local economy, bigger than manufacturing, bigger than government, bigger than healthcare, bigger than education. And so all of that has come to a grinding halt as people can no longer flip these houses and kind of create fictitious wealth.
So I understand that, but I got a lot of questions for you. We'll take a short break. But when we come back on manufacturing, if the U.S. economy has to be reshaped to dig out of this, if we have to stop running the massive trade deficits, if we've got to make new investments in alternative energy and everything that comes along with that, it's not perfectly clear to me why that might not redound to the benefit of the Rust Belt, but we want to hear your case on that. Richard Florida joins us from Toronto. His big piece is How the Crash Will Reshape America. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour with urban theorist Richard Florida about regional winners and losers in the current economic bust, what the economic map of the country will look like on the other side. His cover story in The Atlantic magazine is How the Crash Will Reshape America. He's author of The Rise of the Creative Class and Who's Your City. He joins us today from Toronto. Let's get a call from Northampton, Massachusetts. And Michael, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I guess I'm wondering, I read the piece in The Atlantic, and I heard you talk, and I'm just wondering about Pittsburgh and places like that and why we can't learn more from those. So places like Buffalo or Cleveland or St. Louis that you've talked about can't do what Pittsburgh did or what Columbus or Minneapolis, for that matter, have done.
Richard Florida, how about it? And for that matter, look at Chicago and Detroit side by side. You're pretty bullish on Chicago, not so bullish on Detroit. What about those two and the others that Michael mentions?
Well, I am kind of a fan of Detroit, and we'll get to that later because my wife's entire family is from Greater Detroit, and I spend a lot of time there. So we can talk about where their assets are. But I think he makes a great point about Pittsburgh. I lived in Pittsburgh and taught at Carnegie Mellon for 17 years. And what I think happens is it takes at least a generation for a city and region to begin to recover. Think about New England and the body blow that New England had in the Depression and immediately following the war. And I remember when I attended MIT as a graduate student, even the area around MIT was kind of a bombed out wasteland. Yeah. It took a full, and this was in the 70s and 80s, it took a full generation for kind of the greater Boston area, with all of the great things going for it, with fabulous universities and a lot of intelligent and knowledgeable people and startup companies, to turn around. Pittsburgh was completely on it, flat on its back when I moved there in the early 1980s. But through a lot of hard effort, and particularly not only top-level leadership, what they call these community development corporations that were neighborhood-based, they undertook the long, hard work of beginning to rebuild community and beginning to get the universities and all of those institutions more to be the fulcrum of growth. I think there's a lot to learn, but the point is, a place that gets hard hit like Detroit is today, and I think the assets in Detroit are actually the fabulous universities, Wayne State in the city, but also the University of Michigan and Michigan State, quite close by. Mm. Tremendous assets with which to rebuild, but it takes a long time to go through that process of getting hit with a body blow and then beginning to rebuild and capitalize on a whole new set of assets. But I think the caller's right. There is tremendous amount to learn from this particular case of Pittsburgh.
But take us, for example, to Chicago and Detroit, nearer neighbors, nearer in scale and size than Detroit and Pittsburgh, let's say. And you describe Chicago as kind of sucking up jobs and roles from all over the greater Midwest and thriving with that. Compare that to what's happened not a generation from now, but in the foreseeable future in Detroit. Now.
Well, I think what's happening in this spiky world is that talented people, people who are mobile, who have skills and education, are concentrating themselves. And in a sense, all this kind of business and management functions that used to go on in Detroit or Cleveland, perhaps in Milwaukee, all cities that I quite love, Toledo, are being rolled up into Chicago. And, you know, all you have to do is go for a walk in any evening in Chicago and stop in a restaurant or a bar. You're going to meet kids from all over the Midwest who went to University of Michigan or Ohio State or University of Illinois or University of Wisconsin who've come to Chicago to find employment and to find excitement and energy. The same kind of thing happens in the Southeast in Atlanta. And you can go through in further in the Great Plains in Minneapolis. These are becoming kind of the regional centers of this newer knowledge-driven an economy, and they're rolling up a lot of the functions that used to happen in a place like Detroit. Now, that doesn't mean that a place like Detroit can't survive, but it means it has to position its economy in a very new and different way. It can't expect to be a center the way it was, say, a generation or two ago.
But don't duck this here. You're writing the Rust Belt looks likely to shed vast numbers of jobs. You write some in cities and towns, they Cleveland, will. St. Louis, Buffalo, Detroit will have a hard time. You write will have a hard time recovering. What about the manufacturing argument
unless
there?
Unless they connect to their mega-region hubs. And for Detroit, it would be the implementation of things like fast rail connections to Chicago and Toronto. For Buffalo, the solution's easy, although it's quite hard to implement in practice. Become part of the greater Toronto metropolitan mega-region. So we have to think of, in this way, and I don't mean to push this point too hard, part of Washington, D.C.'s resurgence is not just that it's a government town and it has some AOL high tech. Washington, D.C., in a very real way, has become a suburb of New York. And a lot of the media and broadcast, the NPR functions that are there, XM radio, many of the documentary film producers, many of the writers for the New York Times have actually, from Friedman to Dow to Leonhardt, relocated because of the affordability and connectivity. What this piece is saying, there's a way forward for the Detroits and Clevelands and Buffaloes, but not as isolated economic islands, because their old way of making wealth and value dependent upon these regionally clustered manufacturers. There may be some of it left in the region, but not nearly as much as there was a generation
ago. But, of course, there's a lot of regional talent still around manufacturing there. I want to look at that, but let's get a call here from Omaha, Nebraska. David, you're on the air.
Hi,
David. What do you see there?
Well, the economy is doing all right around here for the most part, but the housing market is starting to give us a crunch right now, and prices are starting to drop, and being a student, well, both my wife and I are students, we're trying to figure out how to remain completely viable and get our feet on the ground running as quick as possible. So,
and how do you think about where to start a career, where to build a life? Are you committed to Omaha? Are you looking across the map of the country and trying to choose? How do you think about it?
Well, honestly, we're looking across the world, because if we're going to be living in a bank with nationalized banks, or living in a country with nationalized banks and having all sorts of crunch being put on all the economy by the government, then maybe it would be a better idea to, we're considering even where she's from. She's from Kyrgyzstan, and we're considering moving there because of the entrepreneurial opportunities there. And she's a business degree, and I'm a biology degree major, and we're looking to maybe pop it on that somewhere else in the near future, because around here, I've just been recently laid off by a company, which I regret to inform everybody, but man, it's a company that was up and running for 2 years, and as soon as this economy started to fall, our business fell and we were all laid off. And our main focus right now was, as I've heard a lot on NPR, is just trying to condemn efforts and families, and we're going to move in with my dad and try to save some money up so we can boost ourselves across the sea and try to make money other way.
A little consolidation right there. And David, we wish you luck with that. Richard, Florida, talk about a thoroughly contemporary story. Sitting in Omaha, looking at the whole world, deciding where to go, maybe going to Kyrgyzstan with degrees in biology and business. If you were young in David's shoes, looking out, let's say you weren't going to Kyrgyzstan, you decided you wanted to stay in this country. How should young people look at the map of where the action may be in their lifetimes?
Well, it sounds to me like David has his head screwed on very straight and is quite well aware of the challenge and the opportunity this crisis presents him and his family. First of all, I think Omaha is something of a success story, notwithstanding with obviously the financial center that they have there, the headquarters of the Gallup organization. They are a story of with the music scene that emerged around Conor Oberst and Bright Eyes. They've emerged as a place that could turn itself around. I think he's right to keep his eye on the world. Obviously, he comes from a multicultural world or family. And I think one of the things that this, what I call not depression or crisis, this great reset is going to do, it's going to make these global centers much more viable. I think the post-war era, the United States, was in a really unique position that it could have, you know, a round number, half of the world's great cities in one country. Well, you know, the U.S. has a lot of great cities, but I think now the rest of the world is catching up. And so in some sense, the proportion of great U.S. cities may shrink, and there may be a proportionally more great cities outside of the United States, and certainly more opportunity, particularly in manufacturing. You know, if you're going to do manufacturing today, a lot of the supply chains are obviously still in the old Rust Belt. But boy, oh boy, if you're thinking about supply chains, take a look at, you know, the interior of China and parts of Asia in terms of where the factories of the future are being built. So I think it's wise to keep an eye on the globe. And what I worry about, what worries me as an American, is that people who would have otherwise come here, whether they're growing up in Asia or India or Latin America, will now say in this moment of crisis, you know what, there is more opportunity for me somewhere in India or China or Latin America, somewhere around the globe, so I will choose not to come to the United States. I'll choose to make one of those other locations my destination. I think that may hurt us. And what we're finding, of course, is that immigration to the United States has finally started to track down in as a result of this recession.
So if you're looking for a target, but if you're looking for targets in this country, do you have recommendations? He's a biology guy.
I've done this. So, I mean, I did it myself, and I actually wrote Who's Your City based on the advice I tried to give myself in thinking about my next move after Pittsburgh. The two places that came up the top of my list were Greater Washington, D.C., which I still think is a boomland, and in fact, in our ratings and rankings, comes up as a great place for singles, a great place for families, a great place for, and I'm just talking about the city, Maryland and Northern Virginia and the whole environment there. I think, obviously, parts of Northern California, if you're going to do biology around San Francisco and the Silicon Valley, although housing is extraordinarily expensive, I think parts of the college towns that are close by in the Midwest, perhaps Madison, Wisconsin, which offers biotech startups, and of course, whether you like it or not, if you're in the pharmaceutical industry, you're going to have to look at parts of New Jersey and Philadelphia. One of the points this book, Who's Your City, makes, and we have a place finder at our website at creativeclass.com where you can actually do this for yourself, is that it's not only that lifestyle offerings are different by place. Places are coming to specialize in different industries. So if you have to make it in a given industry, you're going to find that there's, you know, a relatively small set of, unless you're in higher education or healthcare, a relatively small set of places that really offer you the career options that you need.
And what about manufacturing? Let's come back to that. Barack Obama talks about alternative energy. People talk about, you know, building, I don't know, gazillions of wind turbines and propellers and all the rest, and solar panels and whole new arenas of industry based on alternative energy. Why not see that in Michigan, tied to transportation for that matter? Why not see that in the old Rust Belt? Why not?
You know, my brother-in-law, who works in supply chain management, and his company is actually expanding. We were talking about this weekend. We were visiting together, and he made the same point. He said, you know, you have all this capacity there and talented and people who want to work on these things. Why not a massive effort to retool? The way we kind of, you know, my dad always told me, we retooled the factories for World War II and we stimulated the economy. I just want you to know, Tom, and for listeners who think I might be anti-manufacturing, as I said, my dad worked 50 years in a factory. My whole theory of economic change is built on my earliest studies done in the 1980s of what we used to call quality or high-performance manufacturing. And I actually studied around the world the companies that are transforming manufacturing. My own sense of the company that's most in tune with the knowledge or creative economy, it's not Google or even Amazon or Microsoft or Apple. It's Toyota. And one of the things my other work talks about is there's really two kinds of manufacturing companies. In fact, there's two kinds of service companies and two kinds of high-tech companies. They're the companies that value the input and intelligence and knowledge of their workers They harness that creativity, and they're ones that don't. The ones that harness that creativity and look to workers and people as a source of intelligence, they're going to succeed. And so I think we're seeing a weeding out of older style manufacturing and service and high-tech companies. The ones that survive will be the ones that are organized around this kind of creative impulse, harnessing the knowledge and intelligence. My father told me that when we went to visit his factory. He said, Richard, it's not the machines and technology that make the factory great. It's the knowledge, it's the intelligence, it's the creativity of the men who work here. So I think that's where we're going to have to go in the Midwest if we want to rebuild. And some of the companies, quite honestly, are doing that.
Richard, Florida's big piece in the Atlantic Magazine, Atlantic Monthly, is How the Crash Will Reshape America. Richard, there in Toronto, please stand by. I want to jump across the water and welcome to the show the mayor of Detroit, Ken Cockrell Jr., stepped in for Kwame Kilpatrick when he ran into all of his trouble, got a big election in Detroit right in front of us here, but he joins us today. Mr. Mayor, thank you very much for being here.
How are you?
We're great. We've been reading your State of the City address, which you gave very recently. And Richard, Florida is looking across the country at who's going to come back from this crash, this downturn, and who may not. And he's tough on Detroit. You tried to be pretty straightforward and tough on Detroit in your speech as well, saying too many Detroiters are out of work, too many laid off, too many in foreclosure, and too many giving up hope and leaving. What do you see for Detroit on the other side of this downturn, Mayor Cockrell?
Caught the tail end of your interview with Mr. Florida, so I can't really comment on the substance of it. The one thing that I would say that I do agree with is what he was saying about valuing and harnessing the intellect of people that work within companies. I wholeheartedly agree with that, and in my view, I think the key to revitalizing the city of Detroit, and this is something I referenced in my State of the City speech, is really going to lie in diversifying our economy. I don't think we can continue to put all of our eggs in the auto industry basket. That would clearly be a mistake, and if the headlines of the past 3 months or so haven't taught us that yet, then I don't think we're ever going to learn.
You said in the speech that there's been a lot of bluster and posing. Do you think in this economic downturn, Detroiters are getting real about what they're up against and what it will take to recover, to come back?
I think so. I mean, I think what it's going to take to come back is going to it's going to have to be more than just rhetoric. It's going to have to actually be work, and it's going to have to be an attempt to aggressively reach out to and attract and grow other types of businesses and other types of industry. One of the things that I worked on before becoming mayor about 2 years or so ago is I launched a green task force on our Detroit City Council. Since becoming mayor, I have transitioned that into a mayoral task force, and in December of last year opened up an Office of Energy and Sustainability, which has as one of its focuses being able to grow and being able to attract green industry in the city of Detroit and bring more jobs, green jobs, to the city of Detroit. And I think that's what it's going to take. I think we have to not put all of our eggs in one basket. We have a proud history and legacy of being the birthplace of the modern automobile industry, and I want to continue to support that. I mean, I want to see the big three succeed. But I also know that we got to diversify.
Does manufacturing have to be the bulwark of a comeback for Detroit?
No, I don't believe it does. I don't believe it does. Now, that's not to say that I don't want Detroit to continue to be a manufacturing center. I do. But again, I just think we cannot be wholly dependent on that. At one point, we were very much dependent on the auto industry. On a certain level, we still are, even though many plants have left the city of Detroit. What you still see is that a large number of Detroit residents, they work for the auto industry. You know, they don't necessarily work in the city of Detroit. They may be working in suburban plants or working for suburban suppliers, but they work for it, either directly or indirectly. And again, I don't think that manufacturing is going to be key to Detroit's revival. I see it as a component of Detroit's revival.
We've just got you for another second. Big picture, is your fate going to be decided in Washington with bailouts or right there in Detroit, Mr. Mayor?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Will your fate be decided in Washington where the bailouts get weighed or right there in your own hands in Detroit?
I think our fate is in our own hands. I mean, the stimulus money is something that everybody's looking to and everybody's interested in it. And I think it will be, the way I look at it, is as a jump start to the economy. It will not, however, keep the economy moving. I think it will be very helpful in the short term as a catalyst for putting people to work.
Ken Cockrell, interim mayor of Detroit. Mayor Cockrell, thanks very much for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with urban theorist Richard Florida about regional winners and losers in the current economic bust and what the economic map of the country will look like on the other side. His big piece in the Atlantic Monthly is How the Crash Will Reshape America. He joins us today from Toronto. And thanks to Ken Cockrell, Jr., mayor of Detroit, for joining us there for a few minutes. Let's get a call from Columbia, South Carolina, and Brian. Brian, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I don't see it. I don't think it's going to work that way. I'm sorry.
What do you see coming?
I was born and raised in Columbia, South Carolina, and when I was coming up as a kid, there weren't very many people here. And now, over the course of the last 20-something years, it's exploded.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the jobs have somewhat disappeared. I mean, you have the Walmart came in, you got your Kroger and the McDonald's boom and all that, and then it just kind of leveled off. And we had the nice houses being built, $300,000+ mm-hmm. houses, and they're not selling.
So, do you see a rosy future for your piece of South Carolina or something else?
Not without the innovative ideas. Not without something that's going to make some massive shift in the way that we think about economics and what we produce and what we need. I don't know if changing to green fuels is going to make all the difference. I'm sure every little bit would help.
Richard, Florida, what about the Southeast, South Carolina and beyond there? How do you look at that corner of the country?
Well, I think Brian kind of helps make the point that the article's trying to make is that while the Southeast has many advantages, and certainly I call the great mega region of Charlanta that runs from Charlotte to Atlanta and its environs through parts of South Carolina and includes the North Carolina Research Triangle, while they're one of the world's centers for technology and finance and banking, I think there were many places in the Sun Belt and Southeast, as Brian said, that weren't growing because they had new ideas or new technologies or stable industries. They were essentially attracting people to buy and flip those expensive housing. And the industries that grew up there, businesses that grew up there, were just, as he said, service businesses, Walmart, fast food chains, and so forth. That was unsustainable, and I think we're finding that is proving to be potentially catastrophic for those places right now, especially for people who bought those homes or even for developers who developed those homes. But I think it's going to require a rethink on the part of what those economies want to be. And I think tying into that center of the mega region, the Atlanta, Charlotte, North Carolina triangle, and then also in parts of South Carolina that are near I-75, there has been a southern shift of some of they call this, Tom, the transplant manufacturing. These are the Hondas and Toyotas, particularly the Germans, the Mercedes, the BMW. They are attracted to kind of warmer weather for a variety of reasons and maybe a golf course. Any rate, we've seen some of that manufacturing shift down there, and that's done quite well. But I think all of these places have a future if they look at themselves in the context of what is really new and different about this global economy and how to change their economies to fit in.
Right into the teeth of your piece coming out, Richard, we had a new survey out from the Pew Research Center. David Brooks wrote about it in the New York Times last week, and he talked about maybe urban theorists like yourself saying that, you've got this dream that Americans will give up their love affair with suburban sprawl, rediscover denser, more environmentally friendly, less auto-dependent ways of living, come back to the urban core, ride more bikes, have smaller homes and smaller fridges and all the rest. And he essentially says he doesn't think the new research shows it's going to happen. That Pew talked to a lot of people, asked Americans where they want to live, what they want to do, and Americans said they want to live in Denver, San Diego, Seattle, Orlando, Tampa, and they still speak fondly about suburbs. So which is it?
Well, David is a great guy. He tends not to do any research on his own. He tends to kind of – and he has a particular spin that he likes to provide. I think the Pew study is a remarkable study, and we actually did a study like that with the Gallup organization. I report that in my book, Who's Your City? And I think it's quite simple. Americans are moving to mega regions. There is no doubt that our population is becoming more concentrated in these mega region corridors. Now, Denver is a mega region. Even Phoenix and Tucson are a mega region. Certainly Seattle, part of Cascadia, is an enormous mega region, but so is the Boston, New York, Washington corridor and the rest. Second thing is that many people like where they live, and it's a huge mistake. I talk about this in my book, Who's Your City? to get into this fight, urban versus suburban versus rural. There are some people who would live like to live nowhere better than a suburb with a lovely lawn and a picket fence. There are others who want to be out of the way, up near a mountaintop in a rural area. But there are many, many others who prefer urban life. And one of the things that book, Hoosier City, says is that if you want to be happy in your life, you had better find a place that fits you. That said, one of the things that the Gallup survey has as a point of empirical disagreement is that people in cities are very happy. And now there may be reasons for this different, and the Pew survey said that 52% were happy. Ours is slightly higher, but that many, many people who live in cities are happy, particularly when we control for income. Even then, we find that low-income people many times are happier in cities than in other places. So the point is, I think that people can be happy where they are. And I think the other point is, we're not going to become a suburban sprawling nation again because we simply can't afford the, it's not just the energy costs. We simply can't afford the time costs. If we want to move in that developmental pattern and try to reinforce what my piece calls the old Fordist mass consumption suburban-oriented model, we are going to continue to bankrupt this country, and that sooner or later, another competitor, a set of competitors that have a more efficient, better, less time-consuming a geographic structure will begin to eclipse these regions economically.
And you're saying the federal government ought to make policy changes that actually begin to lean away that super emphasis on suburban homes and home ownership. You want to get rid of the tax advantages for home ownership and try to encourage more rental. Why?
Well, it's something I've been working on since my dissertation. My dissertation was actually on the U.S. housing system and system of housing finance, and I hadn't picked up on it until this current reset. One of the things we've learned is that the solution to economic recovery is never a government stimulus or monetary policy easing. It's not simply Keynesianism, as we're told. It's not massive government spending. It's not even just having your industries become more productive, what the great economist Joseph Schumpeter called the gales of creative destruction that reset our industries. It actually is a new way of living. What really resets our economy is the creation of demand and new kinds of consumption. The urge to buy new products that comes not from a new set of industries, but of a new way of living. The giant industrial cities of the 19th century that brought people in to consume those early industrial products, but particularly suburbanization. Suburbanization was essentially the fuel for the great auto industrial society. When we bought that house, like my parents did in North Arlington, New Jersey, they then bought a car and they bought a television set and a console stereo and a washing and a Maytag washer and a Kelvinator refrigerator,
everything
and
that came
vacuum
with
cleaner.
It. Yeah.
You remember them?
Yeah.
What we're going to have to do now, if we want to spur demand and consumption for these new knowledge-based industries, remember Brian said this: we need to do this in Carolina. We need to do it. The mayor said this in Detroit. We have to spur demand for new industries. We've got to create a new way of living. And here's the point. Before we could emerge as an industrial society, we had to make food and clothing less expensive so we could spend more money on shelter. If we're going to be a knowledge, health, education, biotech, sustainable energy-driven society, we've got to make housing and transportation less expensive. Right now, people are spending 50% of more on housing and transport. Even in the Obama plan, they're saying write down your housing costs to 38 or 31% of income. Mm-hmm. If you're spending that much on a house, add in two cars, insurance, food, clothing, everybody's up over 50% of their income. What the piece is saying, we're going to have to find a new way of living that makes us less dependent on single-family homes and automotive transport. There's only one way to do that, to shift people, lots more people, into rental housing and stop privileging the single-family home, because it's no longer. The real point, Tom, is one of my students said to me in class, he said, Rich, I've read about, and he was from Latin America, I've read about the American dream. In one thing I've read, it was about economic opportunity. The other thing I read about the American dream was about single-family home ownership. Is it that those two things are in conflict? And I think for many people stuck with a home who can't move out of a place to a new area of economic opportunity, those two facets of the American dream are now in conflict.
But we've got a pretty huge built environment out there of suburbs. I mean, as far as the eye can see, they're there. And they are the size they are.
You know, one of the greatest urban designers and a person, along with Jane Jacobs, the great urban theorist who had a big impact on me, was a man named David Lewis. David is still teaching at Carnegie Mellon. He's in his late 80s. Mm. David said to me 20 or 30 years ago, he said, Richard, the greatest urban renewal project in history is not the inner cities. There's an infrastructure of buildings and capacity and universities and health centers that can be rebuilt, whether that's in Pittsburgh or Cleveland or wherever. It's going to be, how do we rebuild these suburbs that have very little in the way of community assets? And he said, quite frankly, the construction is not of a high level of quality. So I think one of the big tasks when we're thinking about rebuilding and revitalizing the U.S. economy is how will we renew and revitalize these suburbs? And here's the thing. I'm not saying that everyone's going to move back to the cities. What's happening in these great mega regions like the Boston, New York, Washington corridor is that the entire corridor is becoming denser. A great example of this, two great examples of how you can rebuild older centers. Mm. One is right in New England, the great success story of Providence. The other one is in the Washington, D.C. area, the great success story where my office was at George Mason, of Arlington, Virginia, which people saw as a down-and-out town. But when that rail link, the Metro link, came out there and they started to increase densities and build up buildings and bring multifamily rental and condominium housing, Arlington, which people thought was going to lose work and lose people, actually started to not only regain people but regain a functioning, employing jobs and build its economy. Mm. So I think there's a way to reshape it, but it's going to take some thought.
Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee, and Carl. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Pretty well.
Well, I tell you, I'm listening to what he's saying, and I want it to work. I want this regional thing to work because, selfishly, I miss trains. And I believe that railways between region to region within the region is the way to go. And I want my children to be able to enjoy trainways like I did when I was a kid. Another thing is that I feel strongly since World War II, every generation after that of Americans has been looking for a fight to fight. And we've never been able to have that fight. I believe that fight has finally found us. And even though everybody's doom and gloom, I believe this to be an extremely exciting time in our history because we not only get to see these things, we get to rename these things and get to live history instead of reading about history being made. Extremely exciting. And I want to know, what do you think for the future? Also, in the region where I'm here is here in Nashville. I believe we have a great opportunity in this area to really grow and expand ourselves.
Carl, you rock. I'd like to join that fight with you. You're great. Richard Florida, how about it? What do you say to Carl's observation and question on the Nashville region?
Well, I agree with Carl. I mean, this is an extraordinary opportunity. That's why I want to get away. And I noticed in the interview, the online interview for The Atlantic, they titled it The Great Reset, which was the phrase I use. I hate the word depression because, frankly, it's so depressing. What crises can do is give you the opportunity to reset your industries, your technologies, your government-business relations, build social safety nets, but also reset the way we live. And I think Carl is right that the great opportunity here, if we take it, is one, we can come to our senses, get away from the conspicuous consumption and false, phony wealth that we were all bound up with in consumerism, build a real society. Secondly, Nashville, it's funny, if I was David Brooks, I'd be pointing at Nashville as one of the new boom towns because Nashville has done such a smart thing, and I'm actually doing a whole research project on music and the music industry. If you look at what's happened to build a cluster and concentration of commercially viable, business-oriented music, of course New York and L.A. do fine, but there's a third center in there which has sucked up so much of the talent and commerce from other regions. It's Nashville, and now Nashville is getting all other kinds of business relocating because it's seen as an exciting but affordable place to live. So I think Carl's right, and I think he's picked a good place to build that economic future right there in Nashville.
So you find shards of hope here for just about everybody who comes up, and yet your focus is on the mega regions. And what about people who are not in them, one of these great sort of urban dense sprawls? Are you talking depopulation out there, Buffalo Commons here and there all over the country, or something else?
Well, we're seeing it already. I mean, we've seen one of the greatest migrations in human history over the past two or three decades, and there's consensus among urban economists on this, but the people with high degree of skill, high degree of education, are being concentrated in fewer and fewer metropolitan regions, and I would argue in fewer and fewer mega regions. I think that the answer is simple. We have to connect the outlying areas and connect the declining urban hubs to the mega regions. When I was listening to the mayor of Detroit, I was really heartened. You know, as I said, my wife's family comes from Detroit. Mm-hmm. In fact, I wanted to tell the mayor, we have our greatest number of employees for our little company, the Creative Class Group, are in Detroit. Our web person is there. The person who does our logistics is there. The person who designed our space at the Martin Prosperity Institute lives in Detroit and bought a home in the Lafayette Park, the Mies van der Rohe section of beautiful downtown Detroit. But it's connecting Detroit through, and I think Carl talked about this, through fast rail and much higher speed transportation. What the automotive expressway and the highway and the turnpike was to the post-war era, the fast rail is to the mega region. Having Detroit connected to Chicago, and imagine, if you could get from Detroit to Chicago in an hour and a half, Detroit to Toronto in maybe an hour on a super fast rail, that would make Detroit, in effect, a suburb of two of the faster growing places in the industrial heartland. The same thing for outlying areas. We've got to find a way through communications and transport technology to connect them and to build up the scale of these places and bring them to be part of this growing mega region center.
Richard Florida, looking over the lip of our current crisis at a great reset. And I have to say, it is heartening in the midst of all this to think, as Carl in Nashville says, about getting things on a new foundation. I mean, every so often it has to happen. This looks like one of those times.
Yep. And I was heartened by the mayor who said Detroit has to reposition. That made my day.
Well, we'll see what happens in Detroit and who's mayor there as this all comes to pass. Fascinating in itself. Richard Florida, author of How the Crash Will Reshape America in the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. It's always great speaking with you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me back on, and thanks for the callers and the mayor for all their insights. I appreciate it very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.